going?
Pretty good.
Oh my God, your chair.
Thank you.
I have four.
Good.
Jeff, are you getting a lot of audio experience here?
Yeah. Definitely. Especially being in New York.
Oh, that's cool.
How have you been?
Very, very, very fitful.
Fitful?
A lot of things. Yeah. And there doesn't seem to be enough hours in the day to get it done with both dignity and style.
Well, there's a lot of hours in the night.
Well, that's right. I try and stay up as late as I can. After 3 or 4 in the morning, I sort of cack, you know? Mm-hmm. So I got to sort of recharge.
What time do you wake up?
Well, I mean, you know, to teach you in the morning, even at 11 o'clock, I have to get up at 7 or 7:30. So a lot of time. So what's up?
So I haven't really been working that much on the walls lately.
Right.
Mostly working on the computer, actually.
So are you composing on a computer? Computer, or are you?
Drawing on the computer, or painting on the computer.
Well, that's fantastic. So, so what's going on in terms of your explorations? Are you asking specific questions now that you're not asking before? Are you proposing another? Another platform of experience for yourself?
I mean, it's definitely a lot different to work with a different medium. But I've sort of worked on the computer for...
I guess we're talking about priorities. Have you deprioritized and reprioritized?
I think
try and focus a little bit. Try, what could you say legitimately has been deprioritized and what has been prioritized. If you can give a few details.
I was saying I sort of started like my life on the computer, and then over the last few years I started drawing more, you know, in real life.
Right.
Or more on paper.
Right.
And lately I've been going back and into the computer and realizing that it's a lot faster and a lot easier for me to edit things and to make images.
Interesting.
And so I haven't really been, I mean, I've been drawing when I don't have a computer, you know, like mobile, but for the most part, not really doing much on the walls when I get here because I just have this to work with.
That's right. So, I mean, if you have energy that you have to expend and this is a way of doing it, well, why not?
Mm-hmm. And also I've been writing a lot, working on a bigger project.
It's a bigger project. Does bigger mean better? Does bigger mean more important?
Bigger means like a longer time to complete.
Or meaning because it's more inclusive of certain things?
Yeah, it's not just like making one image, which usually takes me like a few days or a day. It's a film.
Oh, it's a film. Okay. It's a filmic endeavor then. Yeah. So does that mean there's a narratological structure and you've got to edit and you've got to sort of pay attention to different types of things? Is there music or a sound element as well?
Well, I'm actually going to... My timeline is that I'm going to spend probably the rest of... Well, right now my time is pretty much divided between this and working on the film and just sort of like relaxing from painting because it's not really sure what I... not really what I wanted to do.
Okay.
It's really just... I just really want to explore image making.
Okay. So I love your sort of totalizing statements. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So...
I mean, it's not about being like a painter... It's just like, that was just a way to learn it, like, you know, to learn very easily.
Right.
How to explore more language visually. And this is like a lot far more better at actually doing that.
So you want to support image making, and then what is the other thing that you said that you responded during one of your crits, and people were like skeptical about your sort of meta-narrative claim? Your meta-narrative was, I want to create more compelling images? I want to make more. Use a figure. What are your words?
Interesting, fascinating.
I want to
good.
Make more fascinating images, more better images, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to make better images, and I want to support image making. So you have these sort of overarching, right?
Yes.
You know, it's like it's as if you were at a Juilliard school, right? And you were majoring in Cal. And people are going to ask you, well, what are you doing? He says, well, I intend to play the piano and to play the piano better. And one would say, well, that would be okay for maybe the first year, but maybe the second year, but not for the third year, and certainly not for the fourth year.
Well, when I'm saying making images better, yeah. It's not just about the technique, it's a little more about making it all better, you know, making like the image better.
But yeah,
the art better, you know.
But I don't disagree. But it would also mean or would imply that you might be referencing for your own sake and maybe for the sake of your listeners as well, what your source material, for instance, is or was or has become, right? Maybe source material yesterday is not the source material for today. Mm-hmm. Whatever source, whether it's a memory source, whether it's from the imagination, from the symbolic, from the real, you know, and what source, for instance, one of the many questions, apart from technique or formal questions, which the reason I sort of mention this is because I stress this a lot, you know, that ultimately your mindset, and you've got a pretty distinctive mind for sure, but the mindset is the thing that makes for distinction. It makes for distinctive energy. And at the end of the day, your audience, your naive viewer, your beholder, that's what that person wants. They want to be struck with an unforgettable experience. I've never come across someone who puts energy like this before. Now, so that's how the viewer feels. You, as the maker, have to be, on some level, in control, and on some level, of course, you have to know how to release control.
Yeah.
And that takes an amount of control as well. So there's a paradox involved. That being said, if you can't give an account of what has created the image, of what creates the image...
Oh, I can give an account.
As you make the image, you could perhaps give an account of what has passed after the image has been made. Mm-hmm. You could give a descriptive, maybe, analysis about what constitutes the image, what are the urgencies, why do you have an urge or desire to create this type of form rather than another type of form?
Yeah.
And so again, you the way that you describe your descriptive analysis for yourself, mm-hmm. is, I think, going to set the bar, will offer you demarcation points in terms of how you articulate with yourself what it is that you're again suggesting or proposing.
Yeah, and usually I don't really articulate that with anyone else.
Well, if you're articulating with...
Especially if it's like a critique with like a sort of like a test audience, sort of what I think.
You know, right. Well,
when they're coming in, you know.
You know, you're quite right. I mean, it's for sure. The test audience is in fact a test audience. And the test audience needs to be seen allegorically. And this test audience is a paradigm of how the rest of the world works. So if I have to be prepared for this, and then I can allegorize for the larger event, mm-hmm. upon which the small event is matched.
Yes. You
know, so it becomes a model, in effect. So the test audience. So, all right. So you know, someone once said, and I agree with this, that the wonderful thing about art is that you're not competing with anybody except yourself. Mm. Right. And in order to know that, you have to have a certain game plan, right? In terms of, you know, what is my proposal about, what is my experiment about, mm-hmm. what is my exploration about, mm-hmm. and what are the terms of my exploration, and what is it leading to, apart from infinite surprise and infinite delight, mm-hmm. at one's subjectivity and subjectivities within subjectivity, which of course is evidence. The wiser, in good health, you can handle a, can handle an instrument, right? It's called a computer. And as long as you have, you know, motor control, right, and a fairly open mind, right, inevitably you're going to come up with stuff, right?
Yeah.
So that's a given.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is now, what is not the given? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the exploration that you might sort of ask yourself. What isn't in the, in the, what is not in play? What is being, even unconsciously, what it has not been undertaken?
Well, it's generally everything else I think about, you know, that I don't really like tell other people. You know, it's like the things that I grew up with, things that I watch, my friends, and
right.
Generally it's not too specific, unless it's, I mean, the only specific quality it has is just that it's specific to me, like all of it is specific to my person.
Well,
so I'm not really
right.
exploring like one specific subject, but more of like the aesthetic of like everything that I'm attracted to.
But aren't you attracted to different things in different ways? You're not all uniformly attracted in the same way to all things.
Mm-hmm. Well, just like any person, I'm attracted to like you know, like love or like fantasy. Or
okay, but you're even your fantasy structure is allocated and structured differently depending on what your desire is aimed or pointed at. Right. And so even the fantasy structures, there's a differentiation within the fantasy element, within the fantasy realm. Right? Not all fantasy is the same fantasy about the same fantasy. Right? Clearly, right? I mean, there are distinctions, or there could be distinctions made.
Maybe.
I mean, you allow for that allowance.
I think so. I mean,
you know, in other words, it's not, I mean, obviously the fantasy is, of course, more of it, you know. But what makes for a distinctive fantasy? I mean, what makes for a distinctive fantasy, as opposed to a fantasy that doesn't, you know, that is not as striking? I mean, these are salient questions, right? And they have to be taken in sort of in bold terms, and they have to be taken, you know, in specifics as well. You know, there's and as I said, often what we do is we take it upon ourselves to look at the world and we find, you know, structures, fantasy structures, or people who create the fantasy structures, and we say, well, this is an unusual type of energy, and this is the type of fantasy structure that I relate to, and I get close to, and I got a kick off of, as opposed to this other person who creates this fantasy structure, which, you know, it's all right, but it's not what I would, I get, you know, I get compelled by, right?
Well, my fantasy structure is sort of based around, in general, like the painting and drawing side. Like sort of the two-dimensional, like that's sort of my first like thought when I think of like how I'm, you know, specifically relating like everything in my head to what I'm making. It sort of always has to be like flat. That's sort of like one of the unifying qualities. I don't think that will hold true for like a long time. But and then after that, it's sort of like the things I grew up with, like. You know, like bright colors, thinking of childhood. I've always liked childlike drawings.
Right.
You know, always like the childlike painters. So
right.
It's sort of like where my fantasy structure comes from.
Right.
But also, you know, I haven't really looked at any art world art for, you know, until last year.
Why not?
Because I didn't know what art world was for until last year.
Where were you before Ringland?
I was just in high school, and I wanted to study graphic design.
Where was high school?
In Massachusetts.
That's right, and where in Massachusetts? You're Boston, aren't you?
Yeah, it's in Freetown,
Massachusetts. Tell me about your rather unusual family situation. Is that true? It's a rather unusual family situation.
It's like, it's pretty typical, but it's a little skewed.
meaning it's typically skewed.
Yes, of the typically, yeah, exactly.
Because of the nature of the class that yeah, it's come out of and the variables that remain constant in light of your family, your father's business, and his relationship with his mom, right?
So yeah, but I'm of the average class of public high school.
Right, and so what happened in high school? Lots of things happened in high school. So let's talk about the most important things that happened in high school.
Let's see.
That shaped your creative life and ultimately shaped your destiny. That is, your thoughts about yourself projecting forward.
Probably my biggest things in high school, like the largest events in my life, were becoming a professional gamer, computer gamer, which was took up almost a year and a half of my life.
A year and a half, between the junior and senior year, between
freshman and junior year, like give or take, yeah.
So you became
not 3 years, but like in between those periods.
Okay, professional gamer, right? And the game, the games that you. Constructed. What were you referencing in the world of games? There's some archetypes, right? Because every one of these worlds have founders, right, and major players that create major forms or formats, right?
Well, the game I played was a duel game.
It's a duel game, but you played or you made or both?
Just played.
Okay.
Never made.
Okay, so being a player is one thing, being a maker is another.
Yes. Yeah.
So you played the game. And you focus.
It's like tennis.
Right.
It's
and you
exactly
focus
like
on
tennis almost.
So that got you very sort of involved, right? In terms of getting really good at this game that someone else had invented for you.
Yep.
And focusing for 2 years. On this being, we were talking about repetition and compulsion, right? Mm-hmm. So being very compelled.
Oh, yeah. I was also doing gymnastics at the time. I did gymnastics for like 11 years of my life.
So you were a gymnastics...
But I was never very competitive in gymnastics. I just went to work out. And like they made me compete, but I never really was interested as much as I was the computer game.
Okay, so gymnastics, and how did the visual art get?
Well, I've just always been drawing. So I always thought I wanted to do something like comics or some type of drawing. In middle school, I would have like the stack of white papers from the printer, and at recess I would just start drawing like characters. And it's really been based on characters, because I've been playing games all my life. Since I was little, I used the computer. And I think it's generally been based on like characters and making really short narratives, never anything very complete. All my comics were like maybe like 8 panels, but there was very little dialogue. And it was, if anything, the dialogue was like just a character saying hey, and then another character saying hey, and then like another character moving a little bit. You know, it was very like simple. Not like a superhero comic or it wasn't even, I never even read comics actually. So I didn't know I was making comics, you know, just because that was what sort of like was common.
So when you make the decision, you say it was this particular type of animated or comic character, and you say with that statement, but it wasn't like the superhero type of comic. How do you distinguish one from the other? What pervades in your construct, in your past construct, as opposed to what pervades in the comic hero construct?
Well, in general, one of my comics was about just a kid named like Jimmy or something like that. And another comic was based off a friend called Alex, and I called it Big Bad Alex. Okay. But they're mainly, I was only really interested in the characters. Once I developed the characters and made a few of the comics, I just stopped. Usually, I went on to something else. And in second grade, I had a really big character named T, and I developed like the entire universe in second grade and made big drawings and maps and this whole universe and wrote the whole story. But that was the farthest I ever took it, and really all I ever did was just keep drawing the characters. Never really thinking about the story like sort of abstractly in my head, but never actually
getting into the
writing. Like I've tried to write, you know, like the story, but never really actually could do it. Like it just got bored very fast. So for me, it's like create the character, and then he's almost dead in a way, but he's still there, like he's alive. Right. But he just like the story isn't.
So you like to incarnate. You like to incarnate characters, not give them roles.
And the comics in middle school are like about a duck and a frog, and it's called Duck and the Frog. Usually I think I remember drawing. I can even remember, like, you know, the shapes I was drawing, because I drew them so much. And it was just a duck and a frog, and they were just friends, like there was nothing else. And the comic was just like, he would hop on the pads, and that was it. That was like the end.
And so moving into high school, did you attend the art classes?
Yes. But I was never really good at drawing.
Really? Yeah, I have to make my escape. I missed you, but I'm going to have to come back.
It's no problem.
It is a little bit of a problem, Sam. Why is this terrifying clown looking right at me?
Oh, that's not it's just a picture.
God, it's going to scar me for life. Oh my God, thank you so much for having me. Great, I would love it. You know who I am again? My friend Farley's. Who would have thought that would have happened?
It did.
I'm not going to fight it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Thanks a bunch, okay?
Thank you so much. Absolutely.
Nice
Jeffrey, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance for quality time, but...
Get out of here. Okay.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Bye. Thank you.
Now here's a sort of fascinating character, because you have this this essentialness, right, with her, right? And you have this real sort of, you know, guttural, right?
Like a real worldness.
Yeah, like a real worldness. And along with that, you have this, which is not a veneer.
I actually wrote something down. I have a really good...
Because she strikes us, right?
A really good description for her. I actually was writing this down for my film. Yeah. But it's the Talk to Strangers campaign, which is sort of like a thing, like a campaign that I thought was starting for a while.
Yeah.
Almost like launching a campaign DVD all about, you know, something like trying to somehow make talking to strangers like a big cultural phenomenon in a way that things come in like diets or like, you know, like the secret type of like, you know, how every 10 or 15 years, like, positive thinking gets, like, a new, like, name, you know, whatever they want to call it, like, religion or the secret or the power of positive thinking. I mean, you know what those things are. But I was just, like, fantasizing the other day about Talk to Strangers campaign. Because there's a song in Japan that was actually released called Bottom Biting Bug. And it was about a bug who would bite people's bottoms and they would get married because they would bump into each other. So really, like, the song was about talking to strangers. And it's sort of like a nice, like, cultural thing like that.
You know, I agree with you.
And that's kind of what, like, how I think of her, in a way.
But, let's hold that thought. For instance, I'm with you all the way until you say, and I want it to become like a major cultural thing. It's almost as if you're preempting. You're preempting. You know, you see the end point. And instead of living out, you know, your sensations, your perceptions, your feelings, your thoughts, working the art through, you know, the presenting of the present. It's called duration. You jump to the, you know, jump to the conclusion.
Yeah, I always jump to the end.
You always jump to the end.
I always think of the completeness.
You know, and this is, I think, something you need to sort of, obviously you're aware of it, and to realize what the, in a way...
Well, generally, I can elaborate, because I think, you know, I think of the end a lot, and then usually those things will never happen. So it's always something that's like...
It's a wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
Completely compelled by wish fulfillment. Okay.
It's like if I want to, like, if I have a list, you know, and on them is to be, like, to go to Mars, to be the president, to do all these things, like, as long as I keep those things on the list, I'm going to get, like, I'll be more liable to get, like, halfway there than I would if they weren't on the list. You know what I'm saying?
It's like visualization.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, a visualization, in order for the real-life world, right, to take hold within the ethos of visualization means that you stay in the present, you know, second by second, as you realize, it's called realization, it's called self-actualization, self-realization, so you realize, the self realizes itself through the process without, you know, without
I'm not sure if I follow you.
Without looking at the horizon line. In other words, obviously you have to do both.
Yes.
But the idea, of course, is to juggle, you know, to keep both, to keep sort of both operations working.
But you know what? I don't feel like I'm in that position. You're insecure.
So that's why I'm sort of okay. So back to her. Yeah. One of the you're right. One of the fascinating things is that she's like real world, real life, and real down to earth. And there's a consciousness or a conscientiousness about form. You know, she knows form. She knows the form of her form, which is photography, and can. You know, and not only can but does create work that is at the you know that is obviously part of history, and at the same time sort of resists it, creates a new format. And so she's able to format really through a type of acknowledgement and through her recognition of history. Yeah, and so. I'm convinced, you know, that nothing makes any sense if you don't know history. It's not to say that everything, other things come out of being in the present. But, you know, history really, you know, and we all
I'm pretty much convinced that history is dead.
But we all have history. You have a history and you're not dead.
No, I mean the written history, like the linear history, I feel is, at least for my generation.
Whatever, I agree with you. Whatever form history takes, whether it's whatever form the narrative takes, whether it's a direct narrative, whether it's indirect or indistinct narrative, there is a narrative there. Mm-hmm. You know,
and
to be able to shape the narrative, one needs to be able to articulate one's acknowgement of what form the narrative has taken. Isn't
that? Yeah, I think so.
And in order to do that effectively, as you're doing, you have to be able to sort of pinpoint entry points into energy, and I suppose exit points as well, in order to see what needs to be prioritized, reprioritized, deprioritized.
Yeah.
Move forward.
I'm constantly doing that thing as well.
So
the prioritization of things is always switching for me.
Well, I'd love to hear you articulate, even for a little bit. And maybe you might want to do this as well for yourself, because you can only get better at this, right? You would articulate for yourself, even for a momentary time period. Say, now let me just, even if you feel that it's almost half made up, because after all.
I actually wrote a lot about this.
Really?
Yeah. I'll see if I can pull it up. But I was going to say, I sort of always feel like I'll be eating my food while I'm still cooking it, you know?
What does that
mean? I never think about like the final meal. I'll give you like a perfect example. When I make a meal, I'll start eating and then make the meal while I'm eating. You know, like because I like raw vegetables if I'm making vegetables. I'll start eating a snack before the meal.
Okay.
So there's like a pre-eating. And then there's an eating while I'm cooking, so I'm not getting bored.
Okay.
You know. And then there's the, once I put the plate, it's all on the plate, it's all done.
Yes.
It's all cooked. Then I clean the dishes. I put the dishes away.
Yeah.
And then I sit down. And then I go to the computer and check my email or something, and then I eat. So finally. So it seems like I have to do lots of things in order to get to the end point. And that I'm not necessarily, even though I think about the end before I even start, I still am thinking like the process is always really important, you know,
okay.
Eating well, making it, in a way.
Okay.
You know?
I got that.
Like when I'm on the subway, I'm always like watching the other person across from me, in a way. But at the same time, I'm thinking, like, what if, like looking at the, well, observing this person and drawing them. Or thinking about them, or like recording what they're saying with audio or something. I'm also at the same time thinking like, well, what if everyone, or like, what if I made everyone do this, you know, like in the future?
Right.
And like, you know, there's obviously no way to do that, but the only way to do it would be make a film where everyone does that, or, you know, do something. Is it, you can talk, but I'm going to try to pull this up.
Well, there are two films that are good for you to see. You just saw it, actually. John and I just came back to see it. At the Dumbo Art Center.
Adieu,
Jean. Oui, que Dieu au revoir à Zoe. Que Dieu au revoir à Zoe Strauss.
Ah, okay.
Elle est partie.
Elle est partie.
Ah,
quoi?
Eh bien, voilà. Oui, elle m'a dit au revoir. Elle m'a salué et puis elle est partie. À la semaine, à la prochaine, Jean.
À la prochaine.
Ok.
Here we go. Questions for Dominique.
Okay.
It's pretty specific.
Okay. Go, shoot.
Okay. Is it a... I don't know how many I think. I still want to ask.
Let's start.
That one I pretty much... this was an interesting question. Does an artist have to regress from his own intelligence knowingly in order to make interesting pictures?
Okay. Hang right there. Don't skip ahead.
Okay.
So we go one at a time. Does the artist have to regress within his intelligence in order to create fascinating or interesting pictures?
Or art, yeah.
Does the artist have to regress within his intelligence?
Sort of not think about him. Yeah, you know. In other words, as the bullets are flying, you're not thinking about your combat training.
That seems clear that it's not about that, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, you know what I call my analogy is, and I see this happening when people are doing one thing rather than another. And when they're thinking of combat training, when they're dodging the bullets, I call that a reenactment of energy. And when they're dodging the bullets without pre-thought, I call that the actual dramatization.
Okay.
So reenactment versus dramatization. I think the essential energy can only come through dramatization.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're quite right. I mean, you're using your own language, which you can quibble about, but still. So, question two.
Oh, here's a nice one. I was wondering this myself. Just like talk about the difference between children's images and children's images. I think are really important.
Can you say it again?
Children's images with a quotation, with a apostrophe, okay. Like images made by children, okay. As opposed to children's images, images that society views as childish.
Well,
that can be made by adults or made in children's books. Or
totally. I mean, I think once I had the discussion with. This New York Times writer I mentioned this morning, and what we were looking at was a series of toys, stuffed toys that my partner had gotten in a store, and the claim of these stuffed toys, and they were stuffed, you know, toys, but somewhat odd shapes. And the claim of this company was that these were toys that were...
Oh, yeah, they were drawn by children. Yeah, those are great, actually.
There you go. And so we had a long discussion about where's the reality in all of this? In other words, the adult, meaning the company, the marketing agency, mm-hmm. right, you know, filters, takes the existing
curate the...
Yeah, and they curate it so that it ends up being what adults
want.
Like to believe, right? What adults believe,
the children
want, which is we want to believe that this is what children will respond to because this is innate. Mm-hmm. These are innate forms that would be innate to them, mm-hmm. which of course is projection.
Yeah,
projection, right? So that's true about you know. So what is the real in all of this? Your job being a conscious adult although you may have your fantasies of being a child, but you're a conscious adult about having fantasies about being the eternal child. Your job is to present the relational realities. Mm-hmm. That's your job, is to create a system, you know, which is the child and its relationship to the symbolic order that the adults create for this. And that's what your art should be sort of bearing down on, mm-hmm. in terms of the incommensurables between one and the other, right?
Yeah, that's kind of why I asked the question, because I was thinking
and the paradoxes.
I was thinking all of what I draw sort of asks that question. Continuously, like I'm sort of thinking that.
Okay.
And you asked me to state claims, or like talk about the claims.
Right.
And I wrote some things, I'm going to see.
Right.
Should I read it to you fully?
Sure.
Okay.
You're going to give me claims 1, 2, and 3?
I think it's not numbered. They're just.
Oh, okay. Claim. Mm-hmm. Okay. We begin.
I wrote, I am attempting to create personal figurative images that are universally likable, which means, you know, I pretty much want everyone to be able to like my work.
Okay.
Like, I want to make something likable.
Okay.
And yet never understood fully. So there's always sort of, not very clear as to what's
happening.
Okay,
so there's this type of mystery that we're ending with somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you want people to have access through likability.
Mm-hmm.
Accessibility,
yeah, yeah,
like, and yet at the same time, there's a little level of resistance
mm-hmm.
in the work, correct?
Yes, yes. And then I say, I like when my drawings represent raw, uninterrupted thought, but also when they represent interrupted thought. And then I wrote down for film, like one of my biggest inspirations are some films. The Red Balloon is my favorite film. I'm sure you know The Red Balloon, right? I mean, you're French, so. That's my favorite film of all time. I watched it when I was very, very little. This is my same copy I had since I was like a year old. And then I also wrote Le Jeté. You know that film? Yeah.
So you're putting together The Red Balloon and Le Jeté
mm-hmm.
together.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever read the narrative, the script?
You mean the storybook?
The script.
Is that the script?
Well, I suppose it is.
I haven't read the script, but
I mean the book upon which the film is based, but the actual script.
I haven't read the script.
It would be an issue for you to see, because the script creates this construct, this visual construct.
Mm-hmm.
People actually have to sit down and create an artifice.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because that's what I've been doing with my own film.
Not here, but follow what I'm saying, is that if this is, you know, again, a film that you've been, you know, one of your mental models, it would be good for you to go into the DNA of how this film is actually made as an art piece, and forget art pieces, that's the problem, but just as a creative, you know, as a creative reality, to actually see it, and not take it, to take it no longer only as you remember it seeing it. You're saying it through the eyes of someone who obviously is emerging as an artist. Now, seeing it through the eyes of an artist, knowing how artifice.
Gosh, but to know how long to read the script without.
You would have to.
It would be hard.
It's an illusion.
I think it would maybe
be breaking
not like
the fence, for example. You'd be breaking the illusion bubble.
Yeah.
Right? And you have to take responsibility and enough courage to realize that you have to be able to do this, and then get to the other side of your artwork. Because you're always going to be like at the front end of it without actually seeing, you know, its full dimension if you keep resisting. At a certain point, is that not harm you? Well, if you do it through consciousness and through mindfulness, it's not going to be debilitating. It's not going to make you look at the film with less enchantment. Then you have to sort of trust that. Because the people who made these films are artists. They get what you get.
Yes.
And they get the challenge. When they got the challenge. They met the reality. So trust that. You need to trust that.
Okay.
So, I bet this is a remarkable film for all the reasons. Actually, you know what I thought you were going to say? I thought you were going to say, you've already mentioned, Liberty Press. You don't know the Kickass?
No. What is it?
The Little Prince.
Oh.
I sent it to Betty.
The right? Book?
That's what we were talking about. Well, it became a book, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? I've actually been interested in it, but I've never actually experienced
it. You've never read the book?
I've seen the film, no.
Or seen the film, or the film. But the book, you've never read the book?
No.
It'd be something to try and see.
I've gotten close. I've rented the film last semester, but I haven't watched it.
You are what's typically known as a puer eternus. I suppose you've been involved with that, right?
What is that?
It's called the puer eternus. Let's write this down. It's a term for you. For just an example.
You can spell.
P-U-E-R, right? And then space. Eternus is A-E-R.
E-R-N-U-S? Eternus?
Yeah. A-E-R. Yeah, that's close
fine.
Enough. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you figure out. Yeah.
Okay.
That's okay. That's your archetype.
And then I wrote, I'll just finish this.
Okay.
I said, I wear what I wear because when I go into the store shopping, I pick out the clothes I'm attracted to, just as you must do the same. I'm sort of talking to the students here, actually.
Yep.
I'm a consumer. I like stripes, polka dots, and cheeseburgers.
Right.
We are all forced to be this way living in the time that we are. I cut my hair because I like this haircut. I talk this way because that is what I'd like to talk like. Sometimes there is no explainable reason for wanting to go to Hawaii on vacation other than to just get away. And then I said, maybe that is what I want.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So let's focus.
And then I also said, I want to get away from it all and go on vacation, but because I'm an artist and work all the time, I need to incorporate vacation-like tendencies into all aspects of my work and life.
Absolutely.
Which is sort of like why
absolutely.
Why I always go off. I'm like, you know, like I'll do like a page of this and then the next page will be a life drawing and the next page
okay.
will be, a, you know, it's like a little vacation or something.
That I totally respond to.
Mm-hmm.
That you have to segment, and you're right. You're an artist because the exterior manifestations, the exterior signifiers don't have to be made manifest. It's all interiorized, right?
Mm-hmm.
You create your going away space through your mental energy.
Yeah. That's why I feel like I never really have to. I feel like I never have to really go anywhere. Like, I don't have to go to Hawaii or Alaska. I mean, it's nice to go to those places, but I'm never, like, fully excited about returning to a place. Because I know that wherever I am, I just be, like, just as good.
Totally right. So I think you get something essential, which is great. You're in an essential place, no matter where that place is, which is just perfect. So I'm totally in agreement with and support and encourage again your acknowledgement of that last statement. This is said in what spirit?
Sort of in the spirit of, or like in response to, I guess sort of accusations that I'm a performing, like performance artist, as opposed to just like a person who just performs like any other person. I mean, they would say things like, well, you, why do you wear this? Or like, why are you talking like this? And they say like, because it's in an art school, it's sort of like, oh, is that like art? Is that part of it? But really, that's just like, I've seen other people express themselves. And they've sort of like, I've met friends, like key people in my life who have sort of like helped me learn that like, oh, I can really just, you know, wear whatever it is that I like, you know, I don't have to look like everyone else. So I just started doing that, and it's like a lot better.
Absolutely. And ultimately, everyone conforms in one way or another.
Yeah.
Ultimately. Because the circle rejoins itself, right? You know who's a big ally of yours is Baudelaire, you know, who is the first person to dislike the natural and to, you know, and the eternal truths attached to the natural. And the first writer, which is what makes him the first modern sort of writer, poet or art critic.
He's who we read, he's who we just read, right?
Yeah, and he loves fashion and he loves artifice.
Hmm.
And it's considered extraordinarily bad. Like, this guy's shallow. This guy, you know, is attached to the wrong things. You know, he's superficial. And he's the one who says, this is the thing of our time. This is where truth resides, right?
Mm-hmm.
Potential truth resides. So a little insight for you. You know, to go into Baudelaire's spot. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see you experience intellectual history a bit more. You know, because
as I was reading the mechanical reproduction, I kept thinking how outdated the whole general thought was, especially the idea of the aura.
Well, it is on a certain level, and yet, you know...
Because in a way, it's coming back to the cult value, even more now than it...
Right, absolutely. So you see, to vindicate him a bit, it's not out of fashion at all. It's the thing that returns all the time, and his text remains immutably true for every successive generation. There are parts and aspects...
Well, yeah, there are certain parts.
Certain parts that are inevitably as right as rain. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why... That's why this
But the main thing I was thinking about is in the age, like post-mechanical reproduction, almost in an age where, I guess you could call it the age where everything's already produced, is sort of what we're in now. You know, where it's not about there being 100 iPods, there's one iPod, you know. It doesn't matter that there are multiples, there's just one.
That's right.
And with the internet, you know, the same thing.
That's right.
You know, no matter how many times it's copied, it's not viewed that way anymore. So the aura is actually still there because it's viewed as like an abstract, singular object. That was like my main problem reading the whole thing.
Of course, but the point is that you're a man of your time.
And
this is critical for you to realize, to recognize the mirror of history, to see on some levels there are parallels, on some levels there's, you know, this text written in 1934 does not match up to the existing realities, and for you to see that this juncture is the reason to read this text.
I'm not sure what like intellectual history would be interested in me looking at. You mean like a more philosophy? I have sort of a thing against reading philosophy.
Well, to have something against reading philosophy is the same thing as saying I have something against getting involved in ideas.
Well, in a way, it's
all artists. All cultures.
No, I think it's because I'm for getting involved in ideas, because that in a way like
all the history of ideas,
all the philosophy that's ever been like brought to me growing up is in school. You know, they say, oh, read this philosophy, now read this philosophy. So you're sort of being forced to like look at these ideas in a class.
Encourage.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But for the most part, almost forced.
Well, for you, you're coming from a personal experience.
Yeah, for feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I always felt like, you know, is it a Mark Twain quote, like the famous quote where he talks about not having to read any philosophers? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, but that sounds, it may have come from him.
Okay. This is a really great.
He's a more terrific wordsmith.
This might not be it.
Oh, I see. This is a text. It's a dialogue.
No,
this is his writing.
Hold on.
This is an interview with him. What is this?
It's a. March, well, I think it's Mark Twain.
How about blog?
Sorry. it's going to take me a minute to search for it. Mentions Nietzsche in the quote.
He mentions Nietzsche?
In the quote, yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's interesting. Obviously, he's aware of Nietzsche, right? For him to be able to make a comment on Nietzsche, right? Mm.
It may have been. Okay.
Okay.
Perfectly.
Found it. My entry, 1907.
Mm-hmm. It says, I have not read Nietzsche or Isbin or any other philosopher, and have not needed to do it, and have not desired to do it. I have gone to the fountainhead for information, that is to say, the human race, which is basically, like, really how I feel, you know. Every man is in his own person the whole human race, not a detail lacking. I am the whole human race without a detail lacking. I have studied the human race with diligence and strong interest all these years in my own person. In myself, I find in big or little proportion every quality and every defect that is findable in the mass of the race. I knew I should not find any philosophy, a single thought which had not passed through my own head, nor a single thought which had not passed through the heads of millions and millions of men before I was born.
Okay.
That's basically the...
Be aware of two things. I don't know, so who could disagree with this, right?
He's a magisterial.
He's a magister, right, very agreeable. He's a magisterial thinker. And he's saying, in effect, that you can think for yourself just like I've thought for myself.
But I think what I'm trying to get at is when I go after something, I really go after it. You know, so if I'm reading philosophy, I would really go after it.
But how do you know? You know,
I would start eating it before I finished cooking it.
So when would you ever get out? When would you ever get through it?
I think I just. What do you mean?
I mean, how do you know what you don't know? I mean, if you're always, as I say.
Well, in a sense, I don't. I mean, it doesn't really bother me because I'm finding out so much on my own already. You know, just looking at people.
I suppose I know. Of course, I mean, you're very perceptive and you're quite analytical. You know, I think the thoughts through words are not, you know, again, the decoration, words are not the sort of the decoration of thought, they are itself.
Mm-hmm.
So for you to be able to articulate what you're going through, what you're sensing, right? Is necessary for the very manifestation of what you're sensing through language. That's going to be really, really key for you. We all have to find models, whether it's artistic models, whether it's character models, and models in language. We have to find models. One of the best models is thought, you know, through words. We'll call that philosophy. That sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be philosophy. It could be,
mind talking about philosophy. Of what I talk about is generally like.
But to be able to articulate in terms of when you refer to your work,
mm-hmm.
this is not a pose.
Yeah.
I'm not asking you to create a pose. I'm not asking you to create an artificial veneer, but actually for it to be and actually part of your being. It can only increase your powers.
Yeah.
Both powers of observation, powers of persuasion, and on and on. I can only make it better. I can't. You have a resistance. We all have resistance, but you have particular resistances in terms of, as you say, you know, do I need to regress? You know, in other words, do I have to sort of cut off a type of, you know, conceptual brainwaves in order for me to feel that what I'm doing is right and free. On a certain level, you're right, you have to do that. But our job, you know, there's really no way out of this. You know, my favorite comment is by someone who you would probably bond with because he was fascinated with children, or with the art of the child, which is Dubuffet.
Mm-hmm.
Dubuffet. And Dubuffet, you know, was an historian of the art of the mad and the art of children. The artist pioneered.
Oh yeah, I know. I know all about that.
Right. And he said very famously, you know, that for someone who's part of a social structure, part of society, as you are, going through a school of whatever quality or dubious merit or whatever, part of a structure, the only way to become who, as an artist, to become who we need to become, again, going through these periods of socialization, is by, and it's very the appropriation is very close. He says the only way to do this is by consuming everything that you can. Everything that you can. Everything that's forced on you, everything that you voluntarily, you know, wanna digest, and to get it all into you and then finally vomit it away. Vomit it away once you've also become one. It's the only way. But it's a process, mm-hmm. And one thing has to occur, and then the other thing has to follow it.
That's it.
And I'm a huge fan of Duke Buffet. My God, if you look at the work that he did, you know this man is in touch with something really essential throughout his life. So if you need, you know, validation or affirmation, get it through him. Okay? So, you know, gobble it up, consume it all, and then, you know, at the end of your, you know, at the end of your term, you know, an academic term, right? You know, I never let my education, my schooling get in the way of my education.
It's one of my favorite quotes.
But you know, he was never educated. First, he wrote this at the end of his life.
Very close. Is this near the end of his life?
This is very late. So he writes this very.
Oh, it says he concluded his daily dictation for his autobiography with this passage. So is that the last part of his life?
So he's, but you see what I'm saying? So you look at this in context. There's a man who had no formal education, who was magnificently educated. I mean, in terms of reading everything, knowing the philosophers, right?
Yeah.
And getting back to essential ground, which of course is what we're all trying to do, right? Because it gets in the way of all this scaffolding stuff. You've got to be able to get it and then get rid of it. And that's the trick. That's the trick, honestly. It's a real struggle. And some people are able to do it much better than others. And that is the struggle.
I think, the problem for me is getting rid of it once I get it.
My observation is you have to get it first. I mean, I think you get it first. I mean, I must have not seen it. You sort of build up on it. You build on it. You don't have so much unnecessary resistance because there's no reason to. And if you have fears that some essential.
I don't necessarily specifically resist, reading a philosopher. Like, if I'm reading something about an artist and they mention a philosopher, of course, I'll look them up and then see what's going on.
Okay, that's good.
But in general, I'm not going after them, you know.
Okay.
But as they come to me, I usually digest. I mainly just, I think I'm just a person who generally digests the things that come to me. You know?
Right. But
and as something comes to me, I'll search.
But what do you seek out?
Well, I seek out the things that come to me. I mean, it's hard to explain. Well, for example,
it's so good. No, in other words, apart from the things that come to you, do you ever initiate the seeking out, the calling forth?
Not only
the response, but the calling forth. This is Heideggerian language. The calling forth. What do you call forth?
It's always based on something that's already came to me. There's something that's come to me. For example, I'll be on the train,
right,
and I'll see someone with red sweater. So I'll write down red sweater,
right,
and then I'll Google red sweater.
Okay.
You know, this could be for anything.
Okay.
And then from red sweater, I get this and this and this and this,
okay,
and this. Then I have five more things.
Okay.
And then it does that. And then the next day, going home, you know, I think about something else.
Okay.
But generally, when I'm not observing other people, they're letting things come to me.
Right.
Usually, what I'm thinking about is doing something. Sort of planning the next 10 years of my life, generally. There's an artist who's okay, but he has a really great quote, you know, Julian Schnabel.
Of course I know Julian.
And he quoted. Yeah, it's pretty hard not to. But he has a great quote where he says, "Every day I wake up in the morning in the bed, and I think about what I'm going to do for the next 10 years or the next 2 years of my life, and then when I get out of bed, I forget it all." You know, then I just get back to work.
Okay.
So it's sort of I'm definitely that person. And so the things that I seek out are the things that are way in the future, things that are the Talk to Strangers campaign. Those are things that I'm seeking out, but they're never, I can't search for those things. On Google, I can't get information on them. But slowly like something will come to me and I'll get more information about it, like eventually.
But you know, but I'm not right here.
It'll inform that.
But when I say search, I'm not asking to search for information. I'm talking about to search for knowledge, mm-hmm. particularly self-knowledge. And there's a difference between one and the other. So what is it that you, I'm not asking for a rendition or, mm-hmm. or a list or anything,
yeah.
a space of inventory, it's not what I'm, but for you to sort of ask yourself, you know, what is it that I would actively engage in, you know, in terms of an impulse, in terms of a, without using the word intellectual, in terms of a thought impulse, things that I crave to find out more. Some people, for instance, here are
but it's but those things, I crave to find out about what I see, you know, like the things that I see.
You know, there's some people, you know, are fascinated by questions about and questions about viability, questions about priorities. We talk about class consciousness, and people are involved in, you know, exploring class, you know, issues of class that are always denied by this particular mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. country because of the nature of how it came about.
Well, if you put it that way, then...
No. Okay. So we have issues of class, for instance. I get brought home. Some people, for instance, who are marked by being adopted, for instance, of which I mean more and more, and so over the years, I don't quite know why, are marked, you know, and so they're searching for, it's not so much issues of identity as much as issues of origin, issues of source, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're, you know, so they will be, you know, calling forth, initiating questions about origins. Other people are involved in calling out offering proposals for themselves about belief, about the need for belief, right?
I think that's one of my questions, as well as the belief in the aura, and
so these are, you know, I don't want to say they're basic, but they're pretty key, right? And some I'm glad to do it. And so. So if that were so, that is so, then one would, and it's fun. It's not supposed to be homework. It's just part of your job.
No, that's, right? I mean, I do those things. Like,
and so don't you get involved in it? What is that aura? Okay, so that aura, what's that about? And then, you know, you go into Walter Benjamin, and you go, well, Walter Benjamin was involved with aura. Well, then he wrote about what? So he wrote about other things. What did he write? Oh, he... Writing means thinking, mm-hmm. just being.
Yeah,
which means
yeah.
It's not art, it's not right. Okay, so he's involved in, you know, the mind, the life world, the mind world of the avant-garde, you know, of the French. Again, I mentioned Baudelaire, right? Baudelaire, who is a powerful thinker, right? That you share affinities with in terms of his. Because he's a poet. These people are artists, right? They're real creative people. And they come up with their own conventions. This is the thing. They come up with their own conventions. They don't only, you know, respond to things that are brought to them. They actually, you know, initiate, you know, and thrust forward their own proposals. Mm-hmm. Like Baudelaire comes up with his own proposal, which is a proposal of correspondences. You know, mental correspondences. I refer not to the thing itself, but to the thing that it corresponds to. You know, and you say to yourself, well, that's old man, well, I've known this forever.
Yeah.
And yet, at the time, this is like a whole new approach to the world of the mind, to the world of the self. It's strange, right? And you move to the world, right? And then, you see, I'm building up on that, you know, through, as I say, voluntary memory, involuntary memory, and making distinctions for themselves. And coming up with, you know, through study, self-awareness,
most of my philosophical questions usually, because I was a little brother probably, are things about relativity, you know, like in art of art, and also avant-garde as well, you know, very interested in like the Is it moving forward? You know, does it even move? I'm pretty much like slated on like this idea that I have of a spider web, which I've been relating to a lot of things lately. And also with the way I'm making the movie is that this is going to make a spider web. It's not going to be like a narrative, it's like a web based.
Absolutely.
And I generally think, like lately I've been thinking about the spider web a lot.
It's called Rhizomatic. Did you know about that?
Well, I know spider web. I know Rhizomatic, yeah.
So that's the, you know, that's the analogy that's being made, right?
It's sort of like a non-linear.
Yeah, that's right. It's not arboreal, not structured, not a tree, but it's the roots of it. And this is sort of part of postmodern, you know, and someone has had to codify it for us to realize, that spider thing. Oh, yeah, that's a rhizomatic thing. And then it becomes part of an actual mindset, a world mindset, right? That everybody lives out, whether they can articulate it, whether they even know, you know, its proper terms are, just live out their lives, right? Our job is to be able to articulate. To articulate. This is like the key. So when you say spider web, spider webs. And so what is the analogy that's been made through the spider web? You know, look, the internet, it used to be called the web,
yeah,
right? For obvious reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's the way we identify, that's the way we mirror aspects of ourselves through our technology. These are extensions of ourselves, right? And they get very, very scary after a while. We seem to get more and more distance on some level, and on some levels you get more and more close to what an essential reality is for us, or how we're constantly defining it.